Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. This week, we look at an often underappreciated genre, the Western, in the age of True Grit 2.0. And a bizarre, beloved cult movie arrives on DVD. It's a live-action adaptation of a Dr. Seuss story, and the only one he wrote the screenplay and the lyrics for. And a remembrance of an American singer best known as the voice of Moonlight in Vermont. But first,
if you're looking for final proof that machines are taking over even the most human of tasks, our producer Brent Bachman says he's found it in a new challenge being taken on by artificial intelligence.
Artificial intelligence already exists in a lot of places. It's what recommends movies for your Netflix queue, and even some cars now have automatic parallel parking. But the basic definition of artificial intelligence is when a machine learns to do something.
Basically something that a machine cannot do well, but a human can.
That's Dmitry Genzel. He's a researcher at Google. And maybe you've used Google Translate to transform, say, English into Chinese. Well, Dmitry Genzel is part of a team at Google working with that same technology to tackle what he says is one of the biggest challenges in artificial intelligence, translating poetry. And it's what computer scientists call AI complete.
AI complete.
Which means that it's as hard as any problem that's considered to be in artificial intelligence.
And that's because as you go deeper into poetry, you begin to run into all sorts of things that are a real challenge for artificial intelligence to think about. Length, meter, and rhyme. So take Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven.
Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary.
But say it's in Spanish.
Una vez que promediaba, triste noche, yo evocaba.
So Dmitry Genzel says if you want to translate this to English, here's what his program does.
If you imagine this kind of a huge space of sentences, then there's all these English sentences that you could pick. Some of those sentences have nothing to do with the original.
Once upon a time, in a galaxy far, far away.
So obviously those are bad. Some of them maybe have some of the right words, but they don't make any sense because they're not grammatical.
Dreary, pondering, and weak.
So those also we don't want. So what we do is we search through this huge space of billions and billions of billions of possibilities, and we do it in a smart way so that we pick ones which are both accurate and fluent.
Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and...
But just a quick reality check here. Translating the actual language isn't even the hardest part. Where things get more complicated is with meter. Take Shakespeare.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?
Let's say Shakespeare is usually in iambic pentameter, which means you get five what are called feet, and each foot has two syllables, one unstressed and one stressed.
What Dmitry's program can do is look through a pronunciation dictionary, sort of like you would use to learn a foreign language.
A dictionary that says, okay, the first sound is ah, and the second sound is m, you know.
Compare thee. Compare thee.
So you know exactly how many syllables a word has and where the stress is on the word.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?
But even that, Dmitry Genzel says, is not the hardest thing for artificial intelligence to do.
The hardest thing to do is rhyme, because rhymes are not just in one place in the sentence. It connects to different places.
So let's go back to The Raven. We're translating this line from Spanish.
Una vez que promediaba.
To English.
Once upon a midnight dreary.
But when they get to the word that has to rhyme.
While I pondered weekend.
We don't make one decision, we make a thousand.
That means for every translation that's close.
While I pondered weekend. Teary.
There's another sentence in this thousand that's not even close to a rhyme.
While I pondered weekend. Orange.
So we'll pick orange just as happily, and we'll have to then throw it away afterwards.
Eventually, the computer gets it right, but it takes some time. Google's poetry translation program is not public yet, and full working translations of poetry are probably pretty far off. But, Dmitry Genzel says, working to improve translation software of any kind is still useful.
Most of the content on the internet is not in English anymore. Even for English speakers, if you read a news article about some country, you know, you bet if you open their news site, which may not be in English, and read that, you'll get huge understanding that people don't really see things in the same way as, you know, you might read in the foreign press, for example.
Cowboys are back. Movie fans have ponied up over $100 million so far to see the Coen brothers' True Grit. Earlier this week, a member of the All Things Considered staff made this embarrassed confession during our morning editorial meeting. He said he had seen True Grit and was surprised to find that he liked it. surprised because, as he admitted, he didn't think he liked Westerns. Needless to say, he grew up in a post-Gunsmoke, post-Rawhide, and post-Bonanza decade, and we reckoned that he wasn't alone. So for those of you who roll your eyes at the thought of a drunken saloon brawl or a ride into the sunset, we have invited Bob Mondello, our movie critic, to give us a little starter kit for the multiplex tenderfoot. Howdy, Bob.
Howdy.
Let's start with some basics. What makes a Western a Western?
Well, white hats, black hats, guns, frontier codes of honor, big sky country, I guess.
There are a lot of Westerns that have been made, and we asked you to pick a few. Let's start with the earliest pick on your list. It's from 1953, Shane.
I've heard about you. What have you heard, Shane?
I've heard that you're a low-down Yankee liar.
Now, this is a classic Western. You've got a good guy, Alan Ladd, and the bad guy there was Jack Palance. And it's about being pure in the way that America was pure. It's about the going out there, and it's the frontier, and you're going to make everything right somehow.
Now, a starter kit wouldn't be complete without at least one movie from the director who single-handedly built the Western from the ground up, John Ford, and his favorite star, John Wayne. But the film that you've picked, which was released just 3 years after Shane, is not typical of Ford, Wayne, or the genre. Tell us about the movie The Searchers.
Right. The Searchers is complicated. It's about something more than just good and bad. The good guy, John Wayne, is an unrepentant racist in this. He hates the Comanches. And it's very much about how the settlers treated the Native Americans in that period. It's a very complicated, gorgeous, epic Western.
It's about gray hats.
That's exactly right.
For the next pick, Bob, one which rewrote the rules of the Western a bit, and which can be summed up in one quick line.
If they move, kill them.
It's actor William Holden, the ringleader of The Wild Bunch by director Sam Peckinpah. Why The Wild Bunch?
Well, if the Western can be about something in the Wild West, it can be about other things too. And Peckinpah decided to make this picture about violence. It is much more violent than the previous pictures. A lot of blood on screen, a lot of slow motion violence. And he intended that as a comment on Vietnam. This came out in 1969, and so he meant this to be about other social issues, not just the ones from the Wild West.
And it was that vivid violence that turned off a lot of people, but that changed the rules of making a Western.
Absolutely.
On your list, proving that you're not too predictable, you've added a comedy, one of my favorites, Mel Brooks's Blazing Saddles. And this is not John Ford's Western.
How about some more beans, Mr. Taggart?
I'd say you've had enough.
I'd say it had enough, too. They'd all had enough. That's the campfire scene from Blazing Saddles. I should warn people that this is definitely rated R. The subject matter and the language tend to be pretty adventuresome for the age, but it was a very, very funny picture.
And finally, no list would be complete without at least one film from Clint Eastwood. Which one did you pick?
Oh, no, this was hard because you want to pick one of the spaghetti westerns, but I finally decided that I had to pick something from a little later. It's as if the Western stopped coming out in 1970, so I picked Unforgiven.
I thought they was going to get us. I was even scared a little, just for a minute. Was you ever scared in them days?
I can't remember. I was drunk most of the time.
It is a magnificent Western from 1992, really epic. It's about the old outlaws. This is the end of the era. A lot of people thought, actually, that it was a sort of a eulogy for the form. It ended up not being a eulogy for the form because they made a whole lot of other pictures after it. It sort of inspired a Western revival.
That's a very interesting list you've compiled.
And it's by no means complete, and I know that. I mean, this is five pictures. I've got about 20 on our website, npr.org. If you go there, you can maybe somebody could give us their own starter kit for people who don't like Westerns. I think if you look at these five pictures, though, and you still don't see anything you like, you really don't like Westerns.
Okay. Bob Mondello, thanks for providing us with a starter kit for liking Westerns.
Always a pleasure.
He rode a blazing saddle. He wore a shining star. His job...
We're going now to the East Texas town of Marshall. Before the Civil War, it was the center of the state's plantation economy. The county, Harrison County, says it once had more plantations and more slaves than any other county in Texas. After Reconstruction, it also had more lynchings. Well, today, like so many small towns in the area, Marshall is trying to reinvent itself as a tourist destination for weekenders from Dallas and Houston. As NPR's Wade Goodwin reports, it's doing that by highlighting a lesser-known piece of Marshall history, its role in a musical revolution.
On the vast plantations of Marshall, Texas, cotton was king, but the beautiful fields of white were surrounded in every direction with lucrative pine forests. When slavery died writhing on the graves of 620,000 American soldiers, the black men in those logging camps suddenly became workers. And to try to keep these newly freed men from walking away to a better life, the logging camp owners built what were called barrel houses. They looked like an airplane hangar made out of a giant wooden barrel. In these places, a new sound was born, an early seed of rock and roll. It was called by several names at first, but they finally settled on Boogie Woogie. To the white world of East Texas, this music was invisible, but plenty of upstanding church-going black women knew all about Boogie Woogie, and they thought it came straight from the devil. Say the name out loud, and it even sounded godless.
And my mother was just a stone starch Baptist. She said, "Boy, you're not going to play that devil music in my house. You know, if you're going to play music, you're going to church." So I needed to get on the piano, so that's where I went.
David Alexander grew up in Marshall, Texas in the 1940s and 50s. Unfortunately for his Baptist mother, his father was one of the best boogie-woogie piano players in East Texas. Not in the house, though.
I just used to watch him and his brothers in the backyard. You know, they'd be playing the guitars and singing the blues like, you know, like Robert Johnson and all them guys, you know.
By the time Alexander was 17 in 1955, his fingers could fly over the keyboard. It was a dangerous time and place for young black men. The civil rights movement was beginning to whisper across the South, and the flaming crosses of the Ku Klux Klan lit up the East Texas night.
One day I was downtown, and I saw two white dudes beating a black dude. Then the police drove up, and they got up and stood and looked at it a while, and then they turned their backs while the guy kept beating them, and they lit up cigarettes.
Alexander watched as the black man was beaten to a pulp. He approached another black man who was also watching.
I said, "Man, ain't these people going to do something about it?" He said, "Man, you don't talk about this white folks thing, man. You wind up getting killed."
But Alexander couldn't stop thinking and talking about what he'd seen. He was appalled and wanted the black community to hit back. His family and friends told him to get out of East Texas before he was found hanging in the woods. So that's what he did. He left for California with his talent in his pocket and never looked back, and never came back either, ever. For the next 5 decades in Oakland and San Francisco, he made records and played nightclubs for an enthusiastic and increasingly integrated audience. Back in Marshall, as the 1950s became the 60s, the town began to struggle. The Texas and Pacific Railroad, which had headquarters in Marshall, began to shrivel and die, but the town still retained a southern charm. Buddy Powell is fifth generation from Marshall. His predecessors were Confederate officers, and his father owned all the grocery stores in town until Walmart put them out of business. Buddy is Marshall's mayor.
It was a wonderful place. We had the mill and elevator, which was always cooking something. We had 2 bread companies. The aroma of the bread filled the whole town. Absolutely a close-knit family-type community, and we're hoping to get back there someday.
Last year, fate intervened in the form of a San Antonio doctor. By day, Dr. John Tennyson is a psychiatrist, but by night, Tennyson is one of the country's leading boogie-woogie aficionados. He's got thousands of recordings. And Tennyson knew something about Marshall, Texas, that Marshall itself had forgotten.
In Texas, historically, in the 19th century, African Americans were present in the greatest numbers in Harrison County, of which Marshall, of course, is the county seat. And the oral histories indicate that Boogie Woogie was first played in the early 1870s, which is the same time at which the Texas and Pacific Railroad was getting its start.
Tennyson says those piano players move from one logging camp to another on board the Texas and Pacific. And that's how Boogie Woogie started, the sound of the T&P locomotive running wide open through the backwoods. And on Martin Luther King Day 2010, John Tennyson told Marshall about this amazing style of black music that had been born in their woods. Not a single person on the city council believed him, Mayor Buddy Powell included.
I wouldn't say I was skeptical, I just didn't believe it.
For Marshall's white community, this boogie-woogie thing seemed like it had been dropped from Mars. For Marshall's black leaders, Tennyson's presentation stirred something forgotten, like, oh yeah, I remember that, even though maybe they didn't really. Although almost all the boogie-woogie piano players with ties to the city had died, Tennyson told them there was one guy in California who might still be alive. Finally convinced, Mayor Powell and the city council asked Tennyson to try to find this man named Alexander and ask if he would consider coming home.
I thought maybe it was a joke, you know. I said, what is this guy? You think I'm stupid? Marshall, Texas? What, you going to hang me?
It took a long time for Dr. Tennyson to find Alexander. When Cassius Clay changed his name to Muhammad Ali, David Alexander changed his to Omar Sharif. Tennyson told Sharif, Marshall wanted him to come home for good and be the town's boogie-woogie ambassador. They'd pay for an apartment and a stipend, and he would be Exhibit A of a musical history Marshall had forgotten, but now wanted to remember again.
We want to do something with you. So we got some friends, people down there who admire you. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, are you interested? I said, why not? I said, ain't nobody around you interested in me.
So last month, Omar Sharif came home to Marshall.
You sing my nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much love drive a man insane.
His first two concerts were the biggest integrated gatherings in Marshall's history. When asked what event came in third, both blacks and whites in Marshall shook their heads like there really was no third place. Sharif's second concert in December attracted the attention of two of the best boogie-woogie players in the country, Detroit's Bob Seeley and Bob Baldori, who flew in to play with Sharif. The concert hall was packed out the door. Omar Sharif is having trouble processing it all.
The mayor, man, he said, call me buddy. I said, he saw my friends call me buddy. I said to myself, well, this is the mayor of Marshall, Texas, want me to be his friend? It's nothing like it used to be. It's another world.
Thomas Wolfe says you can't go home again, but maybe if you wait 53 years, things will have changed just enough. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
You may be forgiven if you've never heard of The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. 1953 movie musical was the brainchild of Dr. Seuss, but it bombed. And now, it shows up on cable TV and in special screenings, and it's earned a devoted following. 57 years after its premiere, the soundtrack has finally been released. Our man Jeff London has the story.
As cult classics go, The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T is definitely one of the kookiest.
I want my undulating undies with the marabou frills. I want my beautiful bolero with the porcupine quills. I want my purple nylon girdle with the orange blossom buds. Cause I'm going do-me-doing in my do-me-do duds.
Singer Michael Feinstein is a fan.
This film definitely has a very large and devoted following. And it's something that people discover and either love it and have this thing for it, or they just don't get it.
I want my polka-dotted dickie with the crinoline fringe, or I'm going do-me-doing on a do-me-do binge.
Feinstein gets it. He loves the movie, with music by Frederick Hollander and lyrics by Dr. Seuss, so much that he spent the past 30 years gathering every scrap of music recorded for it. And he found so much material that it fills three CDs.
10 little dancing maidens dancing oh so fine. 10 happy little fingers and they're mine, all mine. They're mine, they're mine.
The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T is a Technicolor fantasy, mostly an extended dream sequence of a boy who doesn't want to practice the piano. He imagines a cockeyed castle where his teacher, now the evil Dr. Terwilliger, has hypnotized his mother and taken 500 boys prisoner so they can play his music on a 5,000-key piano.
This is a movie that was a 1950s sort of homage or sequel, perhaps, to The Wizard of Oz, and that they wanted to create a very significant children's musical fantasy.
The original film score had 16 songs, 2 ballets, and was very dark. Maybe a little too dark.
First floor dungeon. Assorted simple tortures.
The movie was previewed, and there was one problem. It scared the heck out of all the little kids. And they ended up cutting half of the musical numbers.
Mary Healy and Peter Lind Hayes, who were married in real life, starred as the hypnotized mother and the plumber who saves her. Actress Kathy Lind Hayes is their daughter.
My dad had this film at home, and he would pull down the projection screen, and they always said, "Oh, we wish we could get a better version. So much has been cut."
Cut songs like this one are featured in the CD set.
I look to the sky, thanking the stars that you're here.
It seems that my 4th of July came in spring this year.
The CDs really showcase the music of Frederick Hollander, a German composer probably best known for writing The Blue Angel, starring Marlene Dietrich. Alan Leroux is writing his biography.
Frederick Hollander is one of the most unappreciated Hollywood composers of the 30s and 40s, even though he was also very prolific.
While Leroux likes the songs Hollander wrote for the film, he thinks the composer's best work is in the film's ballet sequence.
The great highlight of the score is the dungeon ballet, where musicians who do not play the piano have been consigned, and they burst out of the background in moldy green tatters of their orchestral tuxedos and play a totally surrealist ballet that's a montage of different styles, playing delightful Soussian instruments.
I was a trombone.
George Chakiris, who became famous as Bernardo in the film of West Side Story, made his Hollywood debut at age 20 in the Dungeon Ballet.
For this particular sequence, they needed, I believe it was 60 male dancers, and at that time it was the Screen Extras Guild, and there were not that many male dancers in the guild, so guys who were not members of the guild were allowed to audition. So I auditioned and I got the job, and I made enough money to actually join the guild as well, so it was a good thing.
The film might have been a good thing for Chakiris, but not so for Theodore Geisel, a.k.a. Dr. Seuss. It was a big flop. Alan Leroux says Seuss referred to it as
a debaculous fiasco,
and he never wrote for the movies again. But Kathy Lind Hayes found herself at a screening of The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T in Pasadena a few years ago.
I mean, it was like Rocky Horror Picture Show. They knew all the lines, and they were much, much younger than me. And I thought, well, isn't this interesting?
Come on, it's time we got together, 'cause it's get-together weather, and in get-together weather, together is just what we got to get.
And Michael Feinstein hopes the CD set will attract some new fans.
This is the first official release of the music, and even though some of it doesn't sound terrific, a lot of it does, and it will sound better than it has ever sounded before. So it's a wonderful feeling after literally 3 decades to see this thing in existence.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London.
We're going to take a moment this morning to remember Margaret Whiting. Even if you don't know the name, you may well have heard her voice on some old recording, because she was one of the most popular singers of the 1940s and 50s. She was raised around legendary American songwriters and became one of their best interpreters. and she died Monday evening at the Actors Fund home in Englewood, New Jersey, at the age of 86. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has this remembrance.
Margaret Whiting cared deeply about lyrics, so when songwriter Johnny Mercer said she should sing Moonlight in Vermont, she said, "I've never been to Vermont. How can I sing a song about a place I've never been to?" Mercer said, "I don't know. I'm from Savannah. We'll use our imagination." In the 1940s, Moonlight in Vermont became Margaret Whiting's signature song.
Evening summer breeze, a meadowlark, moonlight in Vermont, you and I and moonlight in Vermont.
When Margaret was a child, the Whiting household was a popular place to hang out for some of the biggest names in Hollywood. Her father, Richard, co-wrote hits like Hooray for Hollywood and Too Marvelous for Words. His friends included Wizard of Oz composer Harold Arlen and songwriter Johnny Mercer. Her aunt was a vaudeville star.
Margaret came out of the womb with musical instincts that cannot really be learned.
Cabaret performer and historian Michael Feinstein.
She not only had the instincts, but had this powerful instrument.
And all those songwriters took notice. Richard Whiting died when Margaret was just 13. Uncle Johnny, as she called Mercer, took her under his wing. She was one of the first artists he signed to Capitol Records in 1942. She was a teenager. Margaret Whiting told reporter Jeff London about the first song she recorded for Mercer.
He said, "We want you to hear something." So he played Black Magic. He sang it. "Do you like it?" I said, "I like it. It's great." He said, "Do you think you could sing it?" I said, "Give me a chance."
That old black magic has me in its spell. That old black magic that you weave so well.
Margaret Whiting was prolific. She recorded hundreds of songs and earned 12 gold records. In the 1950s, she starred with her sister in a TV sitcom called Those Whiting Girls. Michael Feinstein says Margaret Whiting was not necessarily a screen beauty like some of her peers, but she communicated a song like an actor.
She would sublimate her own personality to bring through what the songs were trying to say. And that's why songwriters loved her so much, and I think audiences did too.
Time after time, I tell myself that I'm so lucky to be loving you.
Margaret Whiting continued to perform into her 80s. Michael Feinstein says she also nurtured talented young singers. Margaret Whiting was, he says, darling her whole life. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
I really can't stay.
But baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to NPR's Arts Channel at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.